Welcome to Everyday Theology, where we don't tell you what to believe or why to believe it, but rather explore our Christian beliefs and why they matter for us in relation to God, to creation, and to others. My name is Aaron Ross. Welcome back to Everyday Theology. I'm excited to have someone who I've followed along with his art for a long time, reached out some time ago and said, hey, you want to do a podcast? And he was in the midst of doing a lot of work. So he said, try it later. And then I think a couple months later, and then my life got swamped. I forgot. Text him probably a year or messaged him a year later. And then he said, well, how about in a couple months? And then I almost forgot because life, but we finally made it happen. And I'm glad to have Scott Erickson with me today. Scott, thanks so much for joining.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming.
It has. For my audience here, Scott is an artist, author, performance speaker, and creative curate who mixes autobiography, mythology, and aesthetics to create art and moments that speak to our deepest experiences. I was introduced to you, Scott, through Instagram. I don't remember how or when or in what way, but I felt that same. Your art definitely spoke to me in so many ways. And it still does. And I think now you've kind of written, was it 3 books now in various different topics?
4. Yeah.
4 books.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. So you have a couple on prayer, right?
Yeah, 2 on prayer and then 2 on my own. Yeah.
Yeah. And then 1 on Advent and the Advent season here a bit. You could probably explain that better. But then this one that's more recent called Say Yes, as you kind of put it, an illuminated manuscript about how our darkest moments are actually doorways to a deeper conversation about who we are, why we're here, and how the future bursts with possibilities. I love that. Before we get kind of going in our conversation today about art, mental health, theology, spirituality, and everything, if you wouldn't mind, just introduce yourself. Let my listeners get to know a little bit more about you.
Oh, wow. I'm a person who finds themselves at this time in the world trying to make sense of the complicated life I live in. Look, I'm a visual artist, meaning the way that I process and translate and help understand what I'm going through or what we're in is through image making. And I'd like to continue where I've kind of like solidified on my work is like I'm trying to create a visual vocabulary for the spiritual journey. And I really think our language is rooted in imagery. We're trying to convey what we're seeing externally and internally with our language. And so often transformation comes when we can trade out an unhelpful inner image for something better. And so I have a lot of thoughts about the tradition I grew up in, which was, you know, American Protestantism, Lutheran, but really had no visuals at all, like, you know, crosses right. And doves and stuff like that. But it's interesting, you know, you receive imagery when you're a kid, you get these like cartoons and stuff like that. And then by middle school, we stopped giving images. And it's funny to me that like, none of us think that Jesus actually wore a white robe and a blue sash, but we weren't really given anything else until recently with like these TV shows and stuff like that. And honestly, I don't care. Like, you know, like there's a bit of it where it's like even what's portrayed on TV is like it didn't look like that. Maybe they're trying the best they can with archaeology and stuff like that. Who cares? It's less focused on like what did it look like versus what is the symbol that we take away from these teachings, these stories, and things like that. And I'm processing all of that through my own art form, and that's kind of it.
Yeah.
And then, I've always wanted to make books and would like to keep doing it the rest of my life. And then I've been doing these like one-man shows, kind of interactive experiences. I call them like weird liturgies, meaning like I think there's an element of, I'm big on like telling stories. So let me just tell a story if I can.
Go for it. Yeah.
Years ago, I got invited to this this conference by a group called SIVA, which is Christians in Visual Arts. I just was asked to speak on a panel for like an hour. My friend David Taylor brought me in for that. And it was at in Grand Rapids, Michigan at Calvin College. And because I, you know, was a speaker, I got to be at the conference. And as I'm like sitting at in this auditorium, the conference starts, it was like art professor after art professor just getting up and like reading papers and just being like, this is so important. This is so, look, what we're doing is so important. It matters, you know?
Yeah.
And I just, after a while, I was like looking around, I was like, inwardly, I was like, I'm sorry, is this an arts conference? Where are the weirdos? You know, where is like the Doc Brown from Back to the Future, who's just like, hi, I made this stuff in my garage and I probably smelled too much paint. Because I was like, that's the kind of people I hang out with. That's the kind of people I feel like I am.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I was also like, oh, this is how I feel about church. Not that church isn't full of weirdos. Look, it's still one of the places where weirdos can become members. But I feel like the religious tradition I was a part of got really caught up in being like, isn't this important? Look how important this is. We're so right. This is so important. And I've been looking around and like, I'm sorry, are you not here because you're a weirdo? Like, I'm sorry, I'm here because at some moment in my life, what I thought was reality, I peeked into something deeper than that.
Yeah.
That there was something deeper to existence, and I bumped up against it. And I was like, where do you talk about this stuff? Because if something happened to me, is this not the place we talk about that?
Right.
And I think just through those kind of realizing it, I was just like, oh, we're culture making animals. So I just was like, oh, this is all invented. This form of religion, it's all invented. Doesn't mean it's not true or real or whatever. It's just, it's invented. It's all invented. And I was like, I refuse to believe this is the only way you can invent it. The way that you talk about it, the images you make out of it, the way you do things. I just refuse because, you know, honestly, most adults are really boring. And, as we've entered into adulthood, we're just like, why are adult things so boring? How come adults are so stale, especially in ways of religion? So that's a bit of like my take on things was like, I want to talk about God, but in a way that makes sense in the world that I live in. I want to make art that doesn't stink, that feels like it's gritty, like life is. And I want to make like weird liturgies, meaning I want to make like ceremonies and rituals about the abstract and odd parts of being a human. Because I feel like Christianity, at least that I was a part of, just got really up to really focused on trying to sanitize it and keep the brand cool.
Yeah.
And I just, my experience is that it's all messy and that's delightful. Yeah. There it goes. That was my story.
No, I love that. I mean, and reflecting, right. Like, I grew up in a different tradition. Listeners of the podcast know I grew up very much Pentecostal and now Anglican. We had our own symbols, right? But our symbols were performative symbols, right? Raising hands, you know, I wouldn't
flags. Call
it performative symbols, flags for sure, right? Dances on the stage, right? Like all of that good stuff. Yeah. But to your point, iconography or anything that actually was kind of visually representative in paintings and art were just gone. We didn't have those things either. And it is really interesting kind of walking into a church and thinking that all that's visually adorned might be some kitschy art about Jesus, which is ironic considering that the cover art for Everyday Theology, and somewhat of an ironic nod, is a brown-haired, blue-eyed Jesus with a, not a blue sash, a red sash. So we do have something a little different, right? Okay.
Yeah.
One of my students at my last university made it for me and said, here you go. And I said, this is great. Like, People who are ready for it are going to love it. People who know the irony are going to love it. So, yeah. But that's really helpful, right? Maybe to start, why did you feel the need? Like, was there a moment that hit you that said, you know, I can't express this. This can't be expressed in words, but this visual representation, whether it's an art or a drawing, was able to kind of help move you to that way and that kind of process to these things need to be created in our liturgies.
Yeah. Like, well, I had a number of formative experiences. One was after high school, I went and lived in Strasbourg, France, which is on the east border along Germany. And I lived like four blocks from a cathedral. And I went there every day. It's a beautiful red brick, only one tower cathedral. And I spent a lot of time in that building and walking around that building. And that building was built at a time when most of the society was illiterate. So the way that they and the priest, you know, it was before the printing press, the priest had the only kind of written scripture, and it was in Latin. And so the way that all these stories were told was still orally and through sculpture, stained glass, carvings, things like that. So it was very visual oriented. So the way that it was teaching and forming was through imagery. And then it was because of the invention of the printing press and then it translating into German and then to common language that then it became, and, you know, kind of swinging the pendulum far the opposite way of this very indulgent, it was the very indulgent kind of Catholic thing. They went very like, just like simple room. And all we need is the Bible. So there was a bit of like, I understand that, but there was a bit of like, well, now we just have these words and we can have, you know, that's all we need is we need just words. And yet words are associated with imagery. that was really interesting to me. And that started a conversation, which it was like, what is the role of the artist in the church? Now, cause I don't think we should build cathedrals anymore because it costs like $1 billion. I was like, we should. But how does the artist function in the midst of if it was an illiterate society, maybe there's a spiritual illiteracy that's now, you know, and that was kind of the start of that. I had this experience after college. I lived in Seattle and there was this great coffee shop that had big wall space and they'd let artists put up art and you could do like an art show for a month. They didn't take a cut of it. It was a great place to show art next to a movie theater. It was always busy. So like a thousand people would go through there every day.
Wow.
And just a lot of good exposure. So this one time I had, I made all these paintings and I had some like fun ones. I had like this stormtrooper icon. I had like some Vespa ones or whatever. But then I had this one that's called Forgive Thy Brother, which I've then translated into Forgive Thy Other. And it's these two brothers one who has arrows in his back is embracing the one who is holding a bow, and it's about forgiveness. And I remember I was there for the Friday night opening and nobody was talking to me. I was just sitting at this desk this big guy, like a big guy in a big leather jacket, just a very intimidating guy, comes up and he's just like, did you make all this stuff? And I was like, yeah. Yes, sir, I did. And he was like, he's like, I really like it. And I was like, oh, cool. Thank you. I was like, did anything stand out to you? And he points at that one. He goes, that one. And I was like, oh yeah, why? And he goes, cause I get it. And I had this moment where I was like, oh, Christianity doesn't own the rights to forgiveness. That's just something that's really hard for all human beings to do. And yet all I had been given really was like, forgiveness is a cross and hope is a cross and love is a cross, you know?
Right.
And here I had made an image that spoke about forgiveness, and this guy And I don't know if he had any church background, but this guy was like, oh, I get what that is. And that is what resonates with me. And it was like, so what are the other images? If you took all these like transformation and healing and faith and hope, and are there more images than just a cross, you know,
yeah, or
just
right.
like, and that just kind of started that. Oh, okay. How do you start translating that? And then seeing that women and men have been doing that for hundreds of years, I was like, oh, now I'm being led into that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, but it's different now versus like 15th century artwork, you know, like Caravaggio at the time when he made paintings. We look at him now and we're like, oh, old paintings. But his paintings, you know, in his time, paintings of sacred stories were like big, buff, bulbous characters with drapery, a cast of hundreds, big settings, lights coming out of their head. And Caravaggio was like, I don't want anything to do with that. And he felt very conflicted as a person. He was like, I don't feel like a saint, but I definitely know I'm a sinner. He was like a ladies' man. He had duels all the time. He got kicked out of Italy for a while. He made these, like The Calling of Matthew, one of his very first kind of famous paintings for the church. It's, you know, Matthew is playing in a bar in Rome, and Jesus and Peter walk in, and there's this like hand pointing to Matthew, and this light's coming from behind Jesus, illuminating the hand, and it's illuminating Matthew, being like, I'm calling you. We look at it and we're like, yeah, but they're wearing tights and they have feathers in their hair. It looks old. But in that time, it's like Caravaggio took that story and said, that story's still happening today. It's happening right now in Rome, in the life I'm living in. And that is the same invitation for me, which is to be like, it's not just a story that happened back then. It's a story that's happening right now.
Yeah.
So what, and I'm not even, I look, I have an okay relationship with my art. I don't think I'm a bad artist. But I'm not like the greatest artist ever. I'm fine with what I'm doing, but I'm like, what kind of work do we make out of abstract art, pop art, Andy Warhol, graffiti, Shepard Fairey, Banksy? What is the symbology now that we would make? Because I think a lot of like Christian iconographers still nod back to like bodies and drapery and this kind of cliche.
Right.
I love that stuff. I'm just like trying to push myself on the cliche a little bit. That's a bit of like where that kind of, and I'm still on that journey. Yeah.
What I like about that, and what I was rudely interrupting you to say,
you were not. It's a conversation.
was you know, that the point that you say, like some of our symbols, you know, admittedly are tired, right? Like we've used them so much that they become they don't mean anything anymore, or they become white noise in the way that we look at them. But what I appreciate, and this is actually about your surrounding, is that you don't give up those symbols, because clearly on the wall behind you, there are multiple symbols of the cross.
Yep.
So it's not advocating to give up of those symbols. It's also advocating in so many ways, from what I hear you saying, is we've got to use different symbols, more symbols at different times that help express things that otherwise have become white noise, right?
Yeah. Let's take the cross, for example. And I know this isn't, some people don't like this statement, but I think the cross is a tired image. Here's the thing. I'm not diminishing the cross. The cross, Mother Teresa wore a cross, and the cross is on the logo of the KKK.
Right. Right.
The cross has been bedazzled into jackets, into shoes. It's tattooed on celebrities. Dudes at nightclubs bumping and grinding against ladies are wearing it around their necks. It's ubiquitous. So what does it mean anymore?
Right.
If it's everywhere, what's the context of it? But listen, the cross is a brilliant symbol. Like for 1,000 years, empires use crucifixion as a way of deterring, you know, residents who are being occupied from starting rebellions. They publicly and shamefully executed residents and said, don't mess with us and this is going to happen with you.
Right.
In fact, it was about 300 years after Jesus was crucified before the church even started adopting it as a symbol. They had the fish at first and other things like that, because that symbol was tyrannical.
Right.
And it's a punk rock co-opting move to take a symbol of oppression and make it your symbol of hope. And it's a very simple design, two lines, right? Like for me, when I'm like on every church in the world is an execution device. Like that's punk rock in some ways.
Right.
But you know, it's become like precious moments and stuff like that. And it's kind of diminished it. So you referencing, and those of you listening, wherever you're at, I have a couple images that are cross shapes, but they're symbols making a cross. And so I was a pastor at one of the churches I was a part of. I was telling him my frustration, and he's like, well, there's all these amazing things that are happening on the cross, like all this prophecies being fulfilled and stuff. And I was like, oh, so we worked on this project. It's like up there. I don't know if you can see it, but there called the fulfillment of prophecy. And there's all these symbols and they're all tied to Old Testament stories that are then being fulfilled on the cross. So sometimes you have to make things more. So if the goal of design is to make things simple as possible, to have as much meaning in a simplistic illustration, but when things become so common or just like, oh, I know what that means, I don't have to think about it. Sometimes you need to make things more complex so we unlearn what we think we know about a thing. That it gives us some wonder. We're like, you know, I never thought about it that way, or I never saw it that way. This even happens in my language for my show, Say Yes. I think I only say God like one time. Because God is just a pronoun to a mystery that we don't know how to describe. Right. And God is very short, but God means a lot of things to a lot of people. So it takes more language, but like throughout the show, I say the giver of your existence, which is, you know, the same thing as God, but I came from God. My essence, the creation, it's the creator, it's the maker, but I just say the giver of our existence, giver of our existence. And then there's no real tribalness built around the giver of our existence,
right?
But it's saying the same thing, but without the like, well, what does that mean to me? Or what does that mean to those people? You know, does that make sense? So sometimes it's really helpful to make our words longer instead of shorter. So then it becomes a more dynamic conversation.
I mean, it's very much reminiscent of Paul Tillich and his desire to use different kind of language, ground of being,
the ground of being,
concern, mm-hmm. and these things to help. For various different reasons, one of the ways that Christian theologians can take it away is to go, it does that. It provides more understanding of a term that has kind of lost its gumption, its weight, its...
Great use of gumption.
Yeah, you know, trying. Well, you know, I couldn't help it. I had to call out the Han Solo poster under the cross. It feels like Han Solo's being redeemed a bit, which I'm great.
That was great.
I love it. So, I think... I'm right there with you, right? Like this is, even in my own experience, and I've said this on the podcast before, the dumbest thing actually created for me a moment of considerable reflection. And even before I knew the language of deconstruction, this questioning about my own kind of faith commitments, at least doctrinally, was that Nat Geo reconstruction of Jesus.
Because it
did break out of that, the ubiquity of the brown haired, blue eyed, white robed, blue sash Jesus that I had expected to understand. Mm-hmm. That little bit, which wouldn't even call it art, right? As much as it is just, an artistic rendering of what possibly could have been or look like Jesus.
Yeah.
Can ultimately wreck you in a space that goes, wait a second. I have only processed in one lane for so long. I've lost it. I don't know. Totally. I don't understand. Totally. Right?
Totally. Oh, I had the same feeling with that image. Because my first thought was like, that's not what Jesus looks like.
100% I did the same.
Well, I don't know what Jesus actually looked like. Why would I say that? And then you're like, oh, it's because I've been given all these European and, or, you know, other interpretations. I grew up in a, like a Scandinavian church. So there was very much like a golden haired, blue eyed.
Oh, nice.
Looked like his cousin was the god Thor, you know, like, Jesus. So it is. And then you're like, oh, I have actually, even though I don't think I have an image, I actually do have an image of what I think should look like or should be. Not, and then see, that was another thing that realized, like, oh, okay. So I have these maybe unidentified or unlooked at images that I need to do. Also, because in Christianity, which is still a tradition I don't feel like I need to move on from, I've had to get a lot broader and deeper in my definitions of things. I just kind of set some rules where I'm like, I rarely do crosses and I rarely do pictures of Jesus unless it's like a lamb or some kind of metaphor, just because that stuff all exists and I don't need to add to it. Or I'm not that interested in offering an alternative. Go like, no, he's more brown skin. It's like, great. And I agree, but it's still for me, that's not the point, is like trying to capture what he looks like. It's not, it's more about like what, how, it's more about giving a symbol of like, how is this happening now? You know, I'm not, sometimes people ask me if I illustrate Bible passages and I'm like, I'm not a Bible illustrator. I've taken passages and made illustrations out of it, but I'm not trying to like illustrate what's happening.
Right.
It's not like,
it's almost going the wrong way. It's like trying to use the art to explain, or not even explain, but just to show the Bible in picture versus actually giving the idea. What is this thing trying to help us understand? And so let me give you a visual representation of that thing, of what it's supposed to be, right? Like forgiveness.
Yeah. Because I'm buddies with the YouTube channel, The Bible Project, you know, like I know them and they're doing amazing work and they're doing all of that. And they have a staff of like 150 people. I'm just me in a room. So it's more of like, where am I? What can I offer? What can I uniquely offer? You know, like we're in the season of Lent right now. And years ago, I made this Stations of the Cross. I've made a few Stations of the Cross. And Stations of the Cross is a meditation on how Jesus eventually had to take the process to death, had to go to death. And for me, it was really an invitation of like, Jesus partook in some of like the worst parts about being a human. Like being judged in an unlawful system, being mocked, dehumanized, broken family relationships, physical pain, having to deal like, you know, all of these things. And it's alluded to in scripture, but it's like a tradition that came out of pilgrimages. And so I wanted to like reinterpret that and bring it into a modern context. And what I'm saying is like the Bible Project's not going to take that on.
Right.
If you're a Bible illustrator, you're not doing that because it's based in the Bible. It's based in our sacred text, but it's not like it's a practice of pilgrimage. This is maybe more like I'm trying to make imagery for pilgrimages.
I think it, to your point, kind of circling back, it's something that's been so missed within the church because we had that other swing, that push against iconography, where there was the worshiping of icons versus the recognition that icons can help us see or understand something in ways that we can't currently comprehend, or that words fail at showing us, that sometimes we need it in ways. What I appreciate about kind of the art that you do and the way that you do it is it's not pointed on the nose to say, here's forgiveness, it's Jesus on a cross. Rather, it's here's forgiveness, two people hugging, one with the bow and one with the arrows in their back, right? It says a similar thing. It tries to point to the picture of what does this mean when Christ says, forgive them for they know not what they do, in the, you know, fancy King James way, right? And yet it can do it in a way that someone who has no understanding, no thought process of Christ, can say that thing means everything. That helps me in my own processing, right?
Yeah.
And so to a harder part of the conversation then, which I'll have a disclaimer at the top, but, you know, just disclaimer talking about suicide here. You recently kind of within your book, say yes, you literally at one time posted on Instagram that you called it a Christian book about suicide. What do you mean by that? And how are you kind of looking at the way that you're doing art and the way that you're thinking about mental health and suicide and meaning and kind of pulling all those things together?
Yeah, I didn't post that for like 6 months because I was like, well, for one, I wasn't like trying to be like, here's a product, here's a Christian product for a universal thing. You know, obviously, like, you like rock music, here's Christian rock music. You know, it's like, it wasn't trying to be like,
right,
you think about suicide, you know, suicide book, here's a Christian book about it. It wasn't that. It was more, what happened to me is that, and it's very common as you go through middle age, is like, I actually started getting in touch with like who I wanted to be in the world and what I wanted to do. And I went through some deep depression and I found I was like, you know, I thought about, the way I would say it was like, I didn't necessarily want to kill myself, but if I was crossing a street and I looked and a bus was going to hit me, I'd be like, thank God, you know, I'd be like happy about it. And I had like small kids at the time. And I was just like, I was working with a therapist, but I was really dealing with this stuff. And what I had to develop mental health and spiritual practices to kind of deal with this voice of giving up is what I would call it.
Yeah.
And they're practices I still do today and they really work for me. And I was like, oh, and when you make stuff for a living, you're like, oh, could I monetize this? And then I was like, don't be a jerk, and make sure it works. So I for a few years, I just like made sure that what I was doing actually worked for me. And then I started talking about it with people. And then just like I did a few talks about it. And then Anthony Bourdain killed himself. And right after, I found this out right after I had done a talk in Idaho and in Boise. And I remember walking in this parking lot going, I have some stuff about this. And I need to see if I can offer something to this conversation. And one of my running muses was like, I want to make a church service about suicide because I've never been to one. But I have been to like really boring services, like so boring that you wanted to die while you're in them. And if you made a religious service about suicide that you felt like you wanted to die at, that would be the antithesis to the point.
Right.
And I made myself laugh. Like I made myself laugh and I was like, oh, okay. So I have to make something that's like funny. Like I have to make like a comedy art show. It's not like hitting directly at it. It's like, what are all the things around this thing? Because really, like giving up on yourself is on a spectrum. Because I know a few people who just, you know, binge watch something all the time because they just don't want to deal with their lives. You know, or we've all had or ourselves have gone through some kind of like addiction or numbing through substances, technology, you know, things like that, to just like, because it helps cover a deeper pain we don't want to deal with. And then some people on the far end of the spectrum, just like, I don't want to be here anymore. And I've lost friends to that too. So I was just like, how do you talk about the spectrum? And then maybe what we need is like spiritual mental health practices.
Yeah.
So the whole show is like a delivery system for these simple practices. But they're part of like, but once you get into them, you're like, oh, these are much bigger conversations. Like I had this experience when I was working with a therapist and she was like, you need to start like some kind of physical routine. So I started running because getting out of your head and into your body really helps. But I remember on one of those runs, I was just like running along. And then I was like, well, why the hell am I running anyways? and I bumped up against the deeper existential question. And that's where I'm like, oh, spiritual practices and mental health practices aren't that different. They're just maybe coined by different camps with different perspectives, like clinical and like religious. And so, when I was like, here's a Christian book about suicide. I made that post because I was like, there isn't a Christian book about suicide. And I have listened to this one Christian college that had this whole thing about suicide. And honestly, it was so, it didn't know how to get into it.
Yeah.
Like the guy was just like, he was like, the answer to suicide is the good news of the gospel.
Right. Yeah. The Jesus card that's supposed to fix everything. Just Jesus.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And I was like, no. I am a person of faith who has Jesus in my heart, who at times wanted my heart to stop beating. It's not a product that, like, you're pitching it as a product. This is like a deeper conversation.
Yeah.
And that's actually part of my show, which is like why religion is threatened by this, is because it really pushes on the product-based pitch, which is like, if you get this thing, it'll fix everything.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. It doesn't, because I've had Christian friends take their lives. Jesus in your heart isn't the answer. Well, he wasn't really in your heart. What are we even talking about now?
Right,
we're talking about a little guy in your heart. Like, what are in your aortic valve? What we're talking about is like, we're stuck in some kind of narrative. We're stuck in a perspective that sucks, for lack of a better word, that is hopeless and that is despairing and doesn't know how to get out. In fact, my big kind of climactic scene, not climactic, but my last part is like, is I make the connection where I'm like, being obsessed with the second coming of Jesus or the end of the world is the same thing as suicide. They're both escapism. They're both saying, I actually don't like the miracle of being here. I actually don't want to be in God's good earth anymore. I'd like to be taken out of here to heaven, or just get out of here into whatever's next. They're the same thing. And when that really made sense to me, I was like, oh no, we're talking about, because like, and look, this is, I don't fully get into this, but what happened, a lot of like my quote, you know, you mentioned deconstruction, a lot of stuff in my mid-30s stopped working for me because I had enough, I think enough friends died at young ages, mostly from cancer, a few suicides. And I realized I was like, I'm going to die. And this is a very middle-aged thing to say. And I'm also an artist and an Enneagram 4. but I was like, I'm going to die, and I'm not in charge of that or when it's going to happen. Nor am I in charge of whatever is after that. This is like a water slide into, I don't know what it is. And there's nothing I can do about that. Which is really counter to the American, like, well, you got to say this prayer and then it's all taken care of. And so I was like, oh, but my religion has been so obsessed about afterlife, so obsessed, and end times. I went through end times training growing up.
Oh, yeah. And PTSD. And I was like,
yeah. And I'm, oh, when I remember the nightmares from childhood, it's not Freddy Krueger, it's Sunday night church, watching these horrible videos from the 70s. And I was like, oh, why is my faith tradition so obsessed about afterlife and end times? And I was like, it's because it's abstract and you can control it. It actually, I think they like spending time on that because it might actually feel insecure about this life.
Yeah.
I had a crisis of faith because I was like, well, is there a religion about this life? And I was introduced into, you know, of Franciscan Catholicism through Father Richard Rohr, which a lot of us were affected by him. But he just said Franciscan practices are simply this, that the physical world is the doorway to the spiritual world, and the spiritual world is much, much larger. That framework, so I was given a framework that said, like, the physical world sucks and we're just waiting for the spiritual world.
Right.
But he's saying that in this order, they're going, no, you can't access the spiritual world except through this physical world. There's no way to understand God or that world except through this world. So you must be here. And Jesus alluded to this too, where they're like, when did we feed you? When were you thirsty? And he's like, when you did it to the least of these, you're doing it to me.
Yeah.
He's saying, like, there's something in the tangible materialness of kindness, loving your neighbor, consider the lilies, look at the stars, where he's like, and the portal, the doorway, the thin place, you see just beyond the much, much larger reality that is veiled from us most of the time. And so then, and I'll finish. And then it was, so I was like, oh, there's a way to practice being here that is spiritual. And that is kind of how all this is coming together.
What, you know, it's interesting kind of talking about this, you know, if you just had Jesus in your heart, this thing wouldn't be an issue, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's often that the, at least that I've found in working with as many college students as I have, and me myself, and just community, the worst thing to ever say to a Christian is, let's just Band-Aid fix you with a passage or a Jesus card or a, you know what I mean? Because it doesn't actually help in so many ways be the salve to the actual deeper issue, because we know those things, or because we say, well, Jesus is in my heart, and yet I still feel X, Y, and Z. I still want to give up in certain places. It's only worse when we say, well, if you just actually had Jesus, that wouldn't be that way, because now all of a sudden you're like, well, then how do I do that? Because I thought I'd been doing that for 30 years, right?
Like,
what I appreciate it kind of the way that you're reflecting on this with Rohr and others. And I think Lewis kind of gets there a bit with his understanding of this thin veil, is it doesn't, to your point. I mean, again, I grew up in a tradition that did the same, you know, Pentecostals were all about the return of Jesus. I mean, that was the imminent return of Jesus as part of the fivefold gospel made popularized by Pentecostals. And, and every service,
like top five.
Like every service, there was something about it could happen right now. It could, and it was always, and the reason why I called it like kind of like the PTSD, because it always said, whatever this thing is not good. And there's something better out there. So let's just hurry up and get to that. Instead of, I remember as a kid going, hearing from a pastor saying like, we're going to have, you know, Jesus could come back tomorrow. And I literally thought to myself, let's pump the brakes. I'd like to have a family one day. I'd like to experience some things. Let's like hold off for a second, Jesus.
Oh my gosh. Like, I have, yes.
Like the church is praying for Jesus to come back, and I'm praying, no, wait, hold on a second.
No, I was like, I'm down with Jesus coming back. Can I wait till I have sex first? Because I'd like to.
Yeah, right.
Literally, that's what I thought. I was like, I'd like to have sex within the confines of marriage, and then he can come back.
Yeah, that's mine was just the holier than thou version of like having a family, right? Like.
Oh my gosh. I forgot that I had thought that. That's
you know,
amazing.
It's crazy because, and these are the things that don't happen without these conversations. Like for a pastor who gets up on stage and over again says these things and not realizing the spiritual effect that it has on different generations or different people group or people who've gone through trauma, or not recognizing that this language that we think is great and we couch as biblical ends up being the very thing that hurts people all the more, or actually turns them off from this participation with God.
Yeah.
Well, that's that, then I'm out. Right. And to bring it back to art, you know, I think one of the things that we often miss is that art can bring us back into that participatory reality.
Yeah.
That's lost through the language or someone on stage every Sunday giving their, you know, 30-minute semi self-help, semi maybe I'll use a passage, semi let me just tell you how to live your life.
Yeah.
And yet what we need is affective aesthetic that actually says I can be shaped and molded and changed, and words maybe they can be there, and maybe it's actually just me reflecting on an image of two people hugging. I keep going back to that because that's the one. I mean, I've got your stuff on my screen right now, and I keep getting distracted by the Flo Rida dinosaur since I'm from Florida. I keep so sorry. Like,
nice.
Little aside.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That's one of my most successful images for sure. Cause I was like, wow, that encapsulates a lot of what I'm hoping to do. So yeah, no, I'm glad you bring that one up.
So, you know, I don't want to, I'd be missed kind of. I do this sometimes with my guests when I go, look, your world is different than mine. Like mine's theology. Like I'm in that whole like words thing. Like, you know, that's more of my world. Often if you ask me to draw something, it's the worst. In fact, I've made whole jokes and sermons about how bad I am at drawing and throw it up on the board to say, see, like, I can't illustrate this great. For you.
That's a great teaching tool. That's funny.
So sometimes I ask, you know, if there's something that I have missed in asking, or if there's a part of the conversation that you would go, you know what, a part of this whole conversation, and maybe even going back to this, like this book for helping not giving up, like what would you say? Hey, you know what? You missed something here. If you could have asked the perfect question, this would have been this, and here's what I would have said. Or even still, how does art help overcome that not giving up yourself?
Well, no, I think you've been, bangarang with everything, to reference Hook.
We just watched it. Don't worry. Not Lost.
Lost Boys. Yeah. Rufio. I did a couple books with my friend, Jess McRoberts, about prayer. And when I teach about prayer, invite people to prayer, we'll lead people to be like, look, prayer is this thing that's already happening in you. Words and images and songs help us excavate that. Mm. Scripture helps us excavate that. We've all had this experience when you've read a passage of scripture and you go and you underline it. And then, you know, like a year later, you come back to that same scripture and you're like, well, this part really resonates with me now. Not this part that I underlined right. before. Why? What did the words change? No, it's the conversation you're having change. Mm-hmm. The conversation about God, reality, being here, all of that. And that helps us get in touch with that. It's happening back then as it's happening right now. Another example is like, have you ever been in your car and a song comes on the radio and you're like, oh, this is my song. And you turn it up. What you're saying is you're saying somehow lyrically and sonically, the artist perfectly depicted what it feels like to be in my own skin. And it becomes like, you know, even if it's like fun, it still is like a prayer, you know, it still becomes a vehicle to approach God with. And so, there are sometimes in our seasons of our prayer life that we have all the words and we have all the things to say. And then there's sometimes where you don't know what to say at all and have nothing. And we can draw from, for one, a tradition of women and men who've written down prayers throughout time. And we can draw from that tradition, draw from our sacred texts. We can also draw from images and songs. I tell people, I'm like, just what is the song? What's your song right now? What's getting your attention? What's the one you keep coming back to? And then we live now in an age of like so much imagery. Granted, a lot of it is comparative and off-putting, but like we can, you know, I think why people have really resonated with my work, why I'm on this podcast, why I can't believe I have a living as an artist is because I'm making those excavation tools for people. And I had been doing that for a long time, but when the rise of these platforms, these visual oriented platforms came up, it's like my stuff fit really well in that. So I have, you know, I offer my stuff for that, but there are other things. So we can kind of use these, like even I'm watching you on a Zoom screen, but behind I have this passage of scripture just screenshotted that I just have up for a while because it's really wrecking me. in Ephesians, you know, and just kind of using those things. So art is just one piece. Visual art is just one piece of like words, poetry, music, all these things that are bringing us into that conversation with the divine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Hammocks. It's okay to be afraid of the universe. There's the song.
Oh man.
But that's Hammocks just because I'm
a Hammocks is a great band. Oh wow. That's a good one. Yeah.
Hey, Scott, I appreciate everything. I appreciate having a conversation. I appreciate the stimulation and mind and thought. Before I let you go though, where can people engage with you? Where can they buy your books? And then even if they're in some of the areas that you are doing this, this liturgy of say yes, where can they go to find out more about that?
Yeah. Well, I'm most active on Instagram, but I'm Scott the Painter on all socials. My website is scotterickssonart.com. Yeah, books are available everywhere. Books are sold. It's been like 4 years, but I'm still doing Say Yes shows. Doing one in Columbus, close to you. Should come out. We'll have some pizza. It'll be great. And then I'm working on a next show that I hope to putting it together and starting. Yeah. It's on Paradox.
I thought you were going to say Paradise for a second, and I was going to be like, but wait a second. We just had this. Paradise.
It is a cross section of The Thief on the Cross and Guns N' Roses. And we're going to bring them together.
Paradise. Love City. It.
Yeah, it's John Mark Comer's follow up to Garden City. It's Paradise City.
Oh, man. I'll be waiting for it. I'll be the first in line. So
I should contact him. He's local. We'll just be, I mean, he endorsed Honest Abbott, but like, just be like, hey, Paradise City, let's follow up.
Well, Scott, I appreciate it. It's been a great time, and hopefully I'll have you back in the future.
Great. I love it. Yeah. We'll push it off for like 14 months and then we'll make it happen.
Yeah. But if we start now with talking about it, it'll happen eventually. Right. Yeah. Thanks so much, Scott. Yeah.